Thanks for making it back almost on time. That was very well done, considering the amount of food upstairs. So we're now ready for our first panel, and we're very excited to have these panelists at the front of the room who all have such a tremendous amount of experience. And the panel is called Canada's Responsibility for Detainees in Afghanistan. And I was personally thinking about a lot of about Afghanistan when Isabel was speaking during her first talk, so I'm excited to see what comes out of it. So I'll turn it over to our moderator. This is David Perry, and he's the Deputy Director of the Center for Foreign Policy Studies here at Dow. So I'll turn it over to David Perry.
Thanks, and I just want to say thank you very much for the organizers for inviting me to do this. I think what I'll do is keep my remarks very minimal and leave time for our panel here. And since their bios are in the pamphlet provided, I'll just tell you what they're doing right now. Our first speaker will be Bill Fenner, who is currently teaching international criminal law and international humanitarian law here at the Dow Law School. Secondly, we're going to have Sillery Holmes, who is now a campaigner on international justice, security, and human rights, and holds geographic portfolios for a variety of regions and countries with Amnesty International. And our third panel will be Ms. Daou again, and since you already heard from her earlier, I don't think there's any need for further introduction. So, Mr. Fenner.
Okay. The first preliminary point I was going to make is that although I'm a former military lawyer, I retired from the Canadian Forces in 1994. So my familiarity with the facts here is somewhat limited. I think I've got a pretty good grasp of the relevant legal issues. Having said that, Dean Saunders just mentioned the quotes Chris Greenwood opinion to me. Since I just got back from Baghdad on Monday, my grasp of maybe some of the legal issues is a little rusty. But I hope that I should be able to give you a reasonable overview and set the scene here. First of all, I think a point that's got to be made very clearly is Afghanistan is not Iraq. Canadian forces are in Afghanistan at the request of the democratically elected government of Afghanistan and as part of a UN-sanctioned mission. I think the legal position is virtually irrefutable. They've got a right to be there. They're in there from a political point of view because we, the Canadian people, through our elected governments, both liberal and conservative, sent them there. Having said both of those things, Afghanistan clearly is a country which is notoriously difficult to govern, particularly for foreigners to govern or attempt to govern or attempt to assist the government in. The problem with governing or trying to control Afghanistan by foreigners, it dates back to Alexander the Great. The British in the 19th century had several conflicts in Afghanistan, which normally seemed to end up with the last group of British scuttling across the border with very few survivors. I think we've also got to bear in mind that Afghanistan is a country where it would appear the values of many of the inhabitants are very, very different from ours, particularly concerning such things as women's rights. We may, I believe with good cause, consider our values in certain human rights areas to be superior to theirs. That being said, and I do, we can talk about the importance of recognizing relative values. I think people who don't allow little girls to go to school are swine. We still have to be concerned with whether we should try to impose our values on others and practically whether or not we can get other countries to change their values. It's a simple fact, if Canadian soldiers are employed in a ground combat role in Afghanistan, they will take prisoners or detainees on occasion. That's inevitable. quite frankly, the only other option is conduct combat without taking prisoners. And you're not supposed to do that. That is completely reprehensible. So if you argue that the Canadian forces should not take prisoners in Afghanistan, either you're arguing, which I'm sure nobody is, that we should be violating the law completely, or you're arguing that Canadian forces should not be employed in a ground combat role in Afghanistan. That's the real issue. If, however, one accepts the legitimacy and propriety of employing Canadian soldiers in a ground combat role in Afghanistan, and the consequent likelihood that our soldiers will take prisoners or detainees on occasion, as a matter of simple decency and our Canadian values, it's essential that these prisoners or detainees be treated humanely at all times. Humane treatment, however, is a somewhat nebulous concept. It's rather difficult to try and give it a suitable legal content. What we do here is enter a world where you've got international humanitarian law on one side, international human rights law, domestic human rights standards, all boiling together, trying to figure out which takes precedence and what the proper framework should be, is something which people can legitimately debate about. As a lawyer whose area of expertise is international humanitarian law, I always like to think that international humanitarian law trumps the others. Having said that, I'm not absolutely convinced I'm right. If you look at a decision of the International Court of Justice back in 1996, the nuclear weapons reference case, there the approach that was taken in the ICJ was basically that international humanitarian law was a form of lex specialis, a special body of law, and when it applied, it sort of took precedence over the other bodies of law. More recently, however, one can look at things like a case before the United Kingdom House of Lords last month. The course in a case in El Skeini and others versus the Secretary of State for Defense. This case concerned a request by family members for a public inquiry into the death of Iraqi civilians at the hands of members of the British military during the ongoing war in Iraq. And there, the House of Lords appears to have adopted the approach that, quotes, some human rights law coexists with international humanitarian law in a situation of belligerent occupation, which is something like what we've probably had in Afghanistan. Neither of these decisions would bind a Canadian court, but it's, of course, quite possible a Canadian court would consider these persuasive. My own view is that international humanitarian law, particularly that part of the law which is applicable to international conflicts and embodied in treaties like the Geneva Conventions of 1949 and Additional Protocol 1 of 1977, contain a pretty comprehensive body of law for the treatment of prisoners and detainees, and that complete and effective compliance with that law should withstand any court challenge. It's difficult to determine, just in the just looking at the facts in Afghanistan, what body of law should apply. Whether you're talking about the law for international armed conflict, whether you're talking about the law for non-international armed conflict. One of the things that I did fairly recently was send an opinion to the defense counsel in the Omar Khadr case in our man in Guantanamo about the nature of the conflict there. And certainly you've got some people who would say about the nature of the conflict in Afghanistan, that is not the nature of the conflict in Guantanamo. There you seem to be able to argue that it was it could be either body of law. It was rather awkward to try and figure out which body of law should apply. I think the best thing to do is sort of use the body of law which has the best set of standards, and that's the law for international armed conflict, and whether or not you need some kind of a legal fiction to get there and say, well, let's pretend or let's act as if the body of law for international armed conflict exists. Well, if you need a legal fiction, go with the legal fiction, says I. The Canadian government appears to have adopted the legal fiction approach, although perhaps in a less graceful or complete form initially than one might have preferred. On the 18th of December 2005, the Minister of Defense of Afghanistan and the Chief of Defense Staff on behalf of the Minister of Defense of Canada entered into an arrangement for the transfer of detainees. Under this arrangement, the participants, that's the Canadian forces and the Afghan Minister of Defense, agreed first to treat all detainees in accordance with the standards set forth in the Geneva Convention on Prisoners of War, a good thing. Two, to notify the International Committee of the Red Cross of all detainees and allow the ICRC to visit detainees at any time while they are in custody. Third, the Afghan defense authorities would accept detainees transferred by the Canadian forces and treat them in accordance with the Third Geneva Convention. And fourth, that no detainee transferred by the Canadian forces to the Afghan Ministry of Defense would be subject to the application of the death penalty. Sounds okay. At first glance, it looks like it should work. However, there is a problem. And we'll talk about a strictly legal problem rather than a practical one right here. If you take a look at Article 12 of the Third Convention on Treatment of Prisoners of War, it says prisoners of war may only be transferred by the detaining power to a power which is a party to the convention, which Afghanistan is, and after the detaining power has satisfied itself with the willingness and ability of the transferring power to apply the convention, which hopefully is done. If, however, the original detaining power becomes aware that there are problems, then they have to take corrective action. Now, to be quite honest, I don't know why or the 18th of December 2005 agreement was drafted precisely as it was, because what it does is it seems to assume that, well, the Red Cross is there, the Red Cross has got its own reporting mechanism, and of course the Red Cross is going to inform Canadian authorities. Well, that's just not the way it works. As I would imagine, Isabel is going to be telling you in greater detail in the next while. The ICRC is an organization which where basically every member, I think, takes a vow of confidentiality. Perhaps poverty too. And they can report up the Red Cross chain. They can report to the national authorities of the country where they are visiting. But what they can't do is go in, except in the most extraordinary circumstances, inform another country or generally go public with what was happening. That's the basis on which they work. So expecting the ICRC to inform Canadian authorities if there was any mistreatment of people that we transferred to the Afghan authorities is just something that was never going to fly, and people should have known that. Now, as a result of public criticism, the 18th of December 2005 agreement was supplemented on the 3rd of May 2007 by another arrangement between the governments of Canada and Afghanistan, whereby now Canadian authorities have got sort of, and representatives of the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission have got full and unrestricted access to any persons transferred to Afghan authorities while such persons are in custody. This should, at least from a purely legal point of view, close the loophole, and it should now be possible for Canada to comply in full with its legal obligations. And so that should be the current legal, that is the current legal framework. Exactly how it works in practice, I have some difficulty, well, I don't know, I can't really say how it works in practice, but there certainly is a legal framework in place which allows us to comply in full with all of what our legal obligations are. And I know there have been talks at various points in time about, well, wouldn't it be a good idea to go to the International Criminal Court and this sort of thing? Canadians are obviously doing terrible things. I think, as and mind you, I'm doing a little bit of special pleading here. As a former Canadian military lawyer, I think basically the people I worked with were decent people who took their legal responsibilities seriously, and they did then. I would hope they do even in these extreme circumstances. In my personal case, I am always somewhat reluctant to start off with an adverse assumption about the people I send abroad to die for me. Now that's perhaps stating things very strongly, and I think there is a very definite need for a vigorous investigation and looking at everything that Canadians do. I think they certainly, if you look at some of the things that have happened, not necessarily in Afghanistan, but you look at some of the things that have happened in Iraq, for example, the Haditha massacre, that was an incident where the Americans certainly had a legal system in place which should have required the active investigation of everything that looked like a potential offense committed by American forces, and yet it wasn't until the press got involved that there was a proper look at things. So maybe that second degree of scrutiny is desirable, maybe that's the best way I'd better leave it. I think the legal framework is there now. Hopefully the system will be able to work things out properly in a way in which all of us can be proud. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Holmes.
Thanks for the opportunity to be part of today's panel. Most of you are probably somewhat familiar with Amnesty International, and we're certainly sort of very well known as the organization that coined the term prisoners of conscience and all that sort of thing. But our first worldwide public campaigners, and it's funny, when it was on the abolition of torture, and we've been reporting on the use of torture for almost 50 years, we've been involved in public campaigns for the past 3 decades, and more recently we put the spotlight on torture and ill treatment in the context of the war on terror. And one of the reasons I say this is we come to the issue very much from that prevention of torture lens. It's not the only issue at the heart of questions around handling of detainees, but that's very much the perspective from which we've come to this. Because in part, some people have said to us, and I'll come back to this at the end of my remarks, is why are you defending those detainees in Afghanistan when others are more worried? But from our perspective, it's about prevention of torture and that everyone is worried when it comes to that. Whether it's been sort of testimony during the things like the Iraq Commission hearings or statements in the House last spring, we found that a startling number of Canadian officials, government ministers, are claiming either they aren't really aware of the extent of the use of torture in the world or aren't convinced it's happening. And from our perspective, this sort of commentary defies belief, given how well documented the practice of torture is. In our recent annual report, which is an overview of human rights violations around the world, we documented cases of torture and ill treatment by security forces, police, other state authorities, in at least 114 countries, as as well as similar abuses by armed groups in about 21 countries. And Afghanistan was on both of those lists. So that's the context in which I want to talk about our concerns regarding the transfers of Haini's captured by Canadian forces during operations in Afghanistan and the very low risk of torture, as well as some concerns around lack of process. Although, ideally, I'll be focusing mostly on torture. If you sort of, a lot of people are informed by the media, I'm hoping you go beyond that. But most people would have the impression this is a very new issue. We've actually been campaigning on this since January 2002, and actually slightly before then. But we started raising the issue in letters to government and some public campaigns, sort of late 2001, early 2002. So shortly, it's around the time the Canadian troops were first deployed in Afghanistan, and it became known that in the course of those operations, as Bill said, of course, detention is going to occur. You can't really be involved in a scenario like that without that coming up. Now, at the time, the approach was to transfer any detainees to U.S. custody. And we were concerned about that from the get-go because, particularly around some of the discussions around forming the detention camp and facility in Guantanamo, what you might call the War on Terror detention system is much larger. But that's become very symbolic of the approach to detention in that context by the U.S. because of, like, as I said, I commented earlier, it's intentionally outside of the confines of the U.S. to, for a number of reasons, one of which is to be outside of those courts, but it's essentially been created, from our perspective, outside of any sort of framework of law. That was the norm until December 2005, when the agreement referred to was struck. What that agreement did was provide the further option, not the sole option, but the further option of transfers to Afghan custody, and I think that's an important thing to realize. Popular impression was that the pattern changed from one to the other. It merely provided a further option. And so we immediately began to highlight the very real risk of torture in the Afghan detention system and called for some alternative to be put in place. What we discovered later was that NATO had realized that this was going to be a challenge, talked about building their own detention facility, a joint facility, in the fall of 2005. But what happened instead is a number of countries, Denmark, the Netherlands, the UK, Norway, Canada, it goes to the thought. I might get one of those countries wrong today. Struck bilateral agreements over a period of about 6 months. But they're all slightly, the Canadian agreement was a bit different. And the subsequent agreements in 2007 made it more like the other agreements. And the focus in those was on monitoring. As everyone in the room probably knows, protection from torture is an absolute threat. There is no circumstance in which a little torture is okay. It's also extremely well established in international law. You can look at, if you want to trace the progress, it's in the DV Conventions, it's in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. There's an entire tree, the Convention Against Torture, which outlines it. It's in reference in the Convention on the Rights of the Child, it's referenced in regional treaties. This is a very well established principle of law. And from our perspective, the responsibilities and obligations to protect those in your custody or about to leave your custody apply across the board. No one's, from our perspective, is off the hook, nor should they be seeking to put themselves off the hook. Suggest that they shouldn't be. Over the past 3 years, Amnesty and other NGOs, whether it's Human Rights Watch or others, have done extensive research on the need for human rights reforms within the security and justice sectors in Afghanistan. We actually had a two-year research service in Afghanistan around 2003, 2004, and published a series of reports around the police system, the policing, the justice system, and so on. As been referenced, these systems were devastated by decades of conflict in Afghanistan. They're not strong systems. The international community started to invest in their reconstruction. Particularly around the police and the army. Corrections is always way down the list. I'd say any reconstruction scenario, it's not unique to Afghanistan. But it takes years to rebuild these systems. It takes years and years and years for old practices to change. And this is a very challenging reform environment. It takes a long time for new culture with respects to international human rights standards to take hold. And this is also a context in, it's a context in which professions like the police and the army were not entirely respected professions. There's no reconstruction scenarios, but that's the case. So who's moving into those professions and how they're viewed by communities? You know, how the longstanding problem with corruption and just, you know, you're not even paid, you know, all those issues are flagrant. Your detention conditions are substandard, overcrowding, poor sanitation, inappropriate use of shackling, lack of access to medical care, lack of access to legal representation are norms. And not just here and there, it's still on the norm. A justice system similarly out of repair, short of personnel, training, facilities. The idea of getting a fair and prompt trial is certainly not guaranteed, and the reality is people are still held without charge. In southern Afghanistan, where fame forces are operating, the National Director of Security, which is essentially the intelligence police, for the security intelligence police, has no effective oversight, and needs to be responsible for arbitrary detention, ill treatment, and death in custody, and torture. Some of you may have read the Globe and Mail investigative reports that were published last April. They found that at least 30 detainees transferred from Canadian custody. It was into the NDS, the National Directorate of Security. The list of abuses that they thought the Globe investigated for the document, including beatings, electrocution, starvation, choking, raping, and use of extreme cold. So some rather familiar techniques of torture and ill treatment, unfortunately. But the comment that I actually found the most disturbing in those newspaper articles was from the Human Rights Ombudsman for the Canada Hard Police. So this is the guy in the police system who's supposed to have human rights training on his business card. And what, unfortunately though, and this is what I'm saying, it takes a long time for systems to change. You know, that's a comment you should really absorb, because what he ended up saying, despite being a human rights guy, was actually a shocking disregard for human rights. He actually said, in commenting mostly on the transfer of people to the National Directorate of Security, so not necessarily the local police, but the National Directorate of Security, was that in these cases, these people need some torture, because without torture, they'll never say anything. Now, if I ever said that as a human rights worker, and in my career, I'm telling you, but it is shocking, and it points to the fact that this doesn't change enough. You can say someone's a human rights officer now, but it doesn't mean that they've absorbed the principles, truly believe them, and are following them. The behavior of other Afghan security forces receiving transfer detainees is also troubling. And some of this has been documented on news coverage, so maybe a bit familiar to you. In June 2006, a CTV television crew that was following Canadian forces reported radio chatter with a soldier saying that the Afghan forces were preparing to summarily execute a detainee. And you know, they said, you know, either we get him from them or he's going to be killed. And fortunately they did, and the person was later turned over to a different group of security forces. You know, there's reports of other places where Canadian soldiers have intervened in order to save the life of a detainee, and they started taking extra precautions to choose which security forces they'll hand prisoners over to, you know, being more aware of which will accept them without harming them. And so it's clear that some of the forces are aware of this issue, and they know they simply can't hand somebody over to anybody. And, you know, I think this is something, I'm sort of making this point, because I think the soldiers in those cases are to be commended for their actions. Our gripe is not with Canadian forces, it's with the officials in the Canadian government. I want to be really clear on that, because of some of how, you know, touching this later, how it's to handle in the House and suggestions of, you know, who respects who and this sort of thing, but I want to say that really clearly. You know, so despite all of what I just talked about, the Canadian government has repeatedly stressed that they have assurances from Afghan officials that there's really no need to worry, that transfer detainees will not be tortured. And of course, we have the International Committee of the Red Cross and the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission will play a central role in monitoring the treatment of the prisoners. I'm going to first deal with the question of assurances, what are sometimes called diplomatic assurances. Why they're being accepted in this context, from our perspective, is baffling. That system is struggling. That detention system is struggling. The new officials are struggling. It's not a situation in which that assurance should just simply be accepted. The people who are involved in the reforms in Afghanistan have clearly not been given one. But the other point here is the emphasis on monitoring will is the be all and end all and will save us in this situation. And monitoring is essential. Everyone on this panel, I'm sure, would agree. But even when abundant capacity exists, it's just one component of the broad program you need to actually prevent torture. And the reality is that organizations like the UN and the Human Rights Commission are resource poor. They are a few people without, you know, even the means to travel at times, and they do not, despite various promises, actually have access when they want access to the detention centers. Think about monitoring, you have to think about when I say it's not the full thing. You know, torture can be inflicted with devastating precision in just a few minutes. You know, there are many methods of torture, such as mock execution, simulated drowning, carefully applied electric shocks that don't leave physical marks for a monitor to see. And afterwards, your son may not feel they're actually free to talk about the things that don't leave physical marks. We need to remember them. If you don't have monitoring, that certainly increases the risk of torture. When you do have monitoring, it can help reduce torture. But if you're going to use it, if you're going to try to use it as the primary means to track the fate and prevent the torture and treatment of specific detainees that are dispersed throughout a detention system, again, it's simply an inadequate approach. Not only does it fail to safeguard particular prisoners, but in the event that torture does occur, it doesn't guarantee that there's going to be an investigation. It doesn't guarantee that anyone will be held accountable. And certainly doesn't guarantee any form of redress to the survivor of torture. Your Amnesty has a longer program that talks about the scope of what you need, but it's many of the things that I've referred to before, which is everything from directly ordering that torture should not occur. And again, remember the words of a human rights ombudsperson. It doesn't sound like orders are really being issued. Or understood that they're really meant if they are being issued. It's also training and so, you know, having campaigned on this for years, we've actually chosen to turn to the courts. We've done this before in security certificates, the Safe Third Country Refugee Agreement, and so on. So in February, we did two things along with the BC Civil Liberties Association. We launched an action in federal court, and we also did a complaint before the Military Police Complaints Commission. I'm really going to just talk about the federal court thing right now. So what we've asked for is a judicial review of the first transfer agreement. Because we engaged the courts, and I can move a little slowly, we ended up in May applying for an injunction against transfers. And I'm going to talk a bit about that in a second. Because the result of that was functioning. I just want to clearly say that there's a few things we're not involved in. One is a separate complaint to the Military Police Complaints Commission that was launched by Ottawa U Professor Amir Adaran that's about the conduct of some specific Canadian Forces personnel who it's alleged may have mistreated three detainees prior to their transfer to Afghan custody. We're not part of that action. We knew about it, chose not to be part of it. For a number of reasons, but I want to be really clear, we're not part of that. Some of the same issues have been raised, but we're not part of it. The other thing is a number of people, including Michael Byers from UBC, have made the suggestion that some Canadian Force personnel should be investigated by the International Criminal Court. Again, I'd like to really stress, we're not part of that. We don't agree with those two particular approaches. I don't want to go into a lot of detail why. But I want to be really clear, we're focusing on the various because we're doing some other people doing some other stuff. That's their trip. Amnesty's over here. So getting back to what we actually are doing. So when we made this application for an injunction, what happened the day of the hearing was that the second agreement surfaced. And so the injunction hearing was adjourned. And it was quite interesting because the judge at the time remarked that he felt that the new agreement would not have, the government would not have acted to essentially amend with a supplemental agreement the first, actually called arrangements, not agreements, pardon me, had we not, you know, moved through the courts. There's also been a bit of battle over disclosure documents. We have another application through the Canada Evidence Act because we've been seeking to get some documents that relate to the monitoring of detainees. After some initial access to information stuff, nothing has been released since mid-2006 on the grounds, generally, if I understand it, that it would jeopardize military operations. So we're asking to have that looked at. There's no hearing date for that stuff. The government, though, for our main motion on judicial review, has made a motion to strike, and that is being heard in the middle of October. And it's generally, because our litigation is focusing on the application of the Charter, as well as the international treaty obligations. So you know, they said two things. One, that the charter does not apply extraterritorially, it's hard to say. And that there's questions, they're questioning whether or not we have standing, although there is precedent for public interest standing. Obviously, we are not the particular people who have been tortured or who are at risk, so it's a public interest case. And the other part of this is that the case of Eric's wasting the court's time. Having said that, that is a language used in a lot of, as you may know, motion to strike issues. It's not particularly being targeted to amnesty, but when you're going to do a motion to strike, all this is up for. You know, there's a lot of arguments either way on the extraterritorial application of the charter. So there's precedents either way on that. On the question of importance, though, we're heartened by two things. One is the comment of the judge at the time of our May injunction application, where he said, look, if you hadn't done the court action, there wouldn't have been further action by the government to improve the existing arrangements. The second thing is a Supreme Court decision on hate, which I suggest you look up. And that was the case about an RCMP officer interrogating someone abroad. Now, this can sound a little funny, but actually the Supreme Court in that case decided the charter did not apply extraterritorially. So why would I be pointing to this? Well, there were great things to actually say. That ruling was very much constrained by the limits of that case, and that there would be other circumstances in which the charter may apply extraterritorially. You really have to look at every case. And quite unusually, they also did this. They noted that they were aware at lower levels, in other words, in the federal court, so the Supreme Court said they were aware at lower levels, that an application had been brought by Amnesty International and the BCCLA challenging the transfer of Afghan detainees. And the Supreme Court references itself every once in a while. It's very unusual for it to reference a case in a lower court that hasn't even been heard. So we feel this is a very strong signal from the Supreme Court that the case raises important and challenging issues and it hardly erases it. Of the federal court's time. So we're very encouraged by things like that. I'm going to touch very quickly on four of the points before going over to Isabel Gay. One is, I mentioned this before, we've been really frustrated by how this has been dealt with in the House, especially after the Bill of Amendments article. It became very much a political sort of weapon in football around you know, who does or doesn't support the troops and who doesn't, you know, who believes the allegations of the Taliban over our good men and women. And that's why I really want to make that distinction, you know, who is Amnesty targeting their commentary to. There are also sort of repeated claims and reports from Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, the U.S. State Department, and even Foreign Affairs' own internal human rights reports, that those weren't evidence of a current risk or past patterns of torture in Afghanistan. And it became very sort of unclear what evidence would be. Only a verified complaint from a transferred detainee would be apparently proof that there had ever been any risk of torture in the Afghan prison system. And this reminded me of Roy Alcock, the former head of CSIS during the Iraq mission, where when pressed, he said he really couldn't say for sure that torture had occurred anywhere in the world, let alone Syria. Interesting testimony to read, but that sort of, well, you know, when is proof, becomes very, very frustrating when you're part of an organization that documents this stuff on a regular basis. But the other thing was really this sort of, I don't know, denial, obfuscation, whatever you want to say about how detainees are actually handled, because the agreement covers one of three scenarios. When you do a court application, documents surface, and there's this lovely chart that we got called detainee handbook that does what we suspected. You know, the first question they're asked is this detainee of value to coalition foreign forces for intelligence reasons? If it is, they go to coalition forces. Probably the U.S., but it could be anybody in the coalition. If they're not, There's a supplementary question in this chart, which is, are there Afghan security forces in the area, and can the person reasonably hand it over to them? Can they accept them? Are there the right forces? And I raised some of the concerns before, where Canadian forces have said, yeah, there are Afghan forces in the area, but they're not the right ones to give a detainee to. But that's the second scenario. Then there's the third scenario, where the person is actually temporarily detained by Canadian forces. That's when these agreements kick in. And only in that scenario is the International Committee of the Red Cross informed. In the other two scenarios, they are not informed. And the sort of lack of clarity around this, not to mention the lack of clarity around the role of the Red Cross and all of this, it just hasn't, you know, it's been information poor out there in public discourse, but also just in the House of Commons, for goodness sakes. And that's been very frustrating. You know, there's also the fact that the process rights have been completely ignored. Anyone who has crimes of war, look at page 130. And you'll see what the due process rights are under humanitarian law, let alone under human rights law. a real contrast between sort of development's need to reform the security and justice sector, need to restore rule of law, message from Foreign Affairs, CETA, and so on, versus this acceptance of dubious diplomatic assurances and an evasion of responsibility to protect detainees from torture. This kind of argument, there's a reference to Christopher Greenwood's paper, which is part of the government affidavits. We simply say, international treaty obligations, very minimal application in this context. That's very troubling, because it's a very mixed message. And lastly, just this sort of demonizing of the enemy, of the Taliban, and this leads to this very conditional approach to human rights. This question of, why are you defending people that are not worthy? Other people are more worthy. From a human rights perspective, everyone is worthy, and there are no exceptions.
Thank you. And our final panelist?
Tom Hart to follow.
Oh, but you are working.
So, I guess I want to take you to a different space, which is really the operational space that the International Committee of the Red Cross, here and after the ICRC, occupies in Afghanistan. We've heard about how this is a country that in recent memory has suffered three decades of conflict. In our view, things are not improving. There's really no end in sight in terms of when the conflict might diminish. In fact, the conflict is spreading to the west and to the north. The picture from an ICRC perspective is 20 years of presence. In fact, a temporary presence as early as 1978 and a permanent presence as of 1987. With offices all around the country, including, of course, Kabul, Mazar-i-Sharif, Jalalabad, Herat, Faizabad, Bamiyan. The only place where we're not is Kandahar, although we are supporting the hospital there, but one of our colleagues was murdered there in March 2003, and since then we have security concerns around the safety of our own Red Cross workers. But nonetheless, a vast operational presence. This is one of the ICRC's largest operations in the world after Iraq, Sudan, and the occupied territories. We've got almost 1,200 staff there, and that's over 1,000 national staff and about 65 expatriate staff. And we're also working extremely closely with a very strong national society, and that is the Afghan Red Crescent Society. A very important operational priority for the International Committee of the Red Cross. That means that we are visiting, and I apologize because I misled somebody with the number of detention centers, but we're visiting approximately 68 detention centers, and that corresponds to about 7,000 detainees. So 30, or I don't know how many Canadian transfer detainees is a small proportion for us in the. There might be more of that, but the operations are broad. So we're visiting 7,000 people in Afghanistan at this time. We're also visiting 500,000 detainees across the world. So we're visiting in Guantanamo, we're visiting in Myanmar, we're visiting in a number of contexts. And I'm saying that because I'm hopeful that this will help you understand some of the constraints or limitations under which the ICRC is operating. And I have a huge amount of respect for an organization like Amnesty International for the very vocal way in which you are expressing concerns. But for an operational organization like the ICRC, our modalities is quite different. And I want to take you there and walk you through how we do monitor the rights of those deprived of freedom. So for the ICRC, protection activities means that we are trying to ensure full respect for the rights of individuals in terms of their human rights and in terms of humanitarian law. And we're trying to do that in a very impartial manner, that is, not on the basis of race, national or ethnic origin, language, or gender. So the corporate culture, if I can say, of the International Committee of the Red Cross is very much based on this discrete, confidential dialogue with governments in an attempt to persuade them to modify their behavior, as opposed to using public denunciation, which is a very valid means of doing things.
We do some quiet stuff too, but you still.
But I mean, sometimes I have to say, I'm a lawyer, I'm trained as an advocate and to represent. So it's sometimes I'm in a position where I'm envious of Hillary, in her position of, you know, front page news and let's denounce. And but the ICRC has a very different culture, and I really do believe that these organizations work in a way that complements each other, and with the same goal, which is a protection goal. So the ICRC traditionally will be present in a context. People will be captured, and the ICRC will then have a mandate, but will offer its services to visit detention centers. I'm not really aware of a, anyways, not in recent memory, where the ICRC has been refused access, but it does happen from time to time, especially if the places of detention are secret and we're not aware of it. But in essence, there are four conditions that need to be met in order for the ICRC to start conducting visits. First of all, we need to be granted access to all detainees in all places of detention. In other words, we're not going to accept the fact that the authorities want to show us this prison, but not that one. So access to all detainees in all places of detention. Second condition is that we need to be assured that we're able to interview all detainees in a confidential manner. We don't want any witnesses there. We're going to conduct one-on-one interviews. And this, of course, is to try to assess if there's any torture or ill treatment taking place. Third condition is that we need to be able to register all detainees in that location. And the fourth condition is that we must be able to effect repeat visits. So we're never going to accept the fact that, oh yes, you know, one shot, you could just go there and do it once. No, we need to have repeat visits. The modalities of these visits are very similar. It starts with a preliminary interview with the prison director to try to assess in a general way who's there, what are the conditions, etc. It will be followed then by a general inspection of the prison facilities. Then we follow up, and this might not happen in a single visit, okay? So take in mind that this might happen over the course of several weeks or months. Then we start this process of private interviews with the detainees, one-on-one, no other witnesses. So if they want to have a guard there, no, we're not going to do it, and we're going to suspend the visit. These are all non-negotiable conditions. So the process of these private interviews is very important because that's how, in fact, you acquire the trust. You're trying to build a relationship with the detainees. You're trying to acquire the trust, and therefore you're trying to see whether or not they will disclose any instances of torture or ill treatment. You do your repeat visits. You analyze the information. And of course, then you start drafting preliminary reports or recommendations to the authorities to try to effect certain changes. And you monitor the implementation of the recommendations. That's why you need to have the repeat visits. And if you see that at the director, you know, at the very level of the prison, it's not working, then you move up the chain of command and make your representations higher and higher to the higher level of authorities to try to effect change. Now, there are circumstances where you might speak out publicly, and I will come to that in a moment. One good example of how these visits are conducted is in Guantanamo, where a team of ICRC delegates will arrive and will stay in Guantanamo for a period of 4 to 6 weeks. So we might take that long to actually go through the process of, you know, the interviews, the recommendations, the dialogue with the authorities, the dialogue with the prisoners, etc., etc. And then we might not be present for 2 or 3 months and then go back to Guantanamo, 4 to 6 weeks, same process again. And then the reports are drafted and fed to the U.S. administration. I think Hillary touched upon this, but the visits, in our view, we've been doing this for 100 years, always with the same modalities, is to persuade the detaining authorities to respect their obligations under domestic and international law, to respect the physical and moral integrity of those who are detained, to prevent disappearances and also extrajudicial killings, to prevent torture and ill treatment, to verify the material conditions of the facility. Hillary touched upon this, like access to water, light, you know, etc. To monitor judicial guarantees. And another service that we offer is the link to the families of the detainees. So we do have a system of Red Cross messages, which are public messages that are written by the detainees and censored by the authorities if required, but they're really personal in nature, these messages, so that the detainees can have a contact with their families. In fact, in Guantanamo, those Red Cross messages are the only contact with the outside world that the detainees have through these little pieces of paper that are called Red Cross messages. It's quite moving because, for example, Omar Khadr would write to his grandmother in Toronto through these messages, and the Canadian Red Cross will go and deliver the messages to the family members. So, again, I want to come back to this issue of the persuasion and the confidential dialogue. And as I said, it's been a methodology that we've used for over 100 years, and we do reserve the right to speak out publicly under certain conditions, and I will cite those four conditions. The first one is that the persuasion has failed. So through this relationship, we have not been able to persuade the authorities to change their behavior. The second condition is that the violations are serious and repeated. The third condition is that speaking out publicly would be in the interest of the victims. And the fourth condition is that the ICRC itself has been a witness to the violations or has very credible sources of information validating those concerns. Somebody was asking me, wow, when does that happen? When is it that you actually speak out publicly? Well, I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, I've got the press release in my briefcase. I think it was 29th of June of this year, where the ICRC issued a very lengthy press release against the government of Myanmar denouncing ill treatment of both detainees and the civilian population. Now, those were concerns that were documented over the course of a few years. So, you know, it's a very serious process of documenting and being assured that this is in the best interest of the victims. Now, I think it's interesting because in the media-driven world where we live today, I think that public denunciation is often viewed as almost the only way of getting something happening. And I'm sure that the injunction in time was certainly a big motivator for the government. But, you know, the genocide in Rwanda was denounced by several media and was well documented, and it didn't stop. So it's not the only way, and I think that's why we really need to work in tandem to, in terms of protection, to work on different fronts to make sure that we do attain that protection objective. Maybe a few last words is to come back to the confusion that I think rests around the role of the ICRC in terms of monitoring. The ICRC is cited in both agreements, the 2005 agreement and the 2007 agreement, and we were never told that we'd be cited. Nobody, you know, called us up and said, you know, we're going to cite. We never signed it. We were never informed of it. So it's really not binding in a way upon us. I mean, Hillary was saying that sometimes the authorities are notified of the transfer and sometimes they're not. Well, for us, it doesn't matter because it's business as usual. We're visiting those 68 detention centers. We're visiting those 7,000 detainees. Whether or not we're notified, we're in there. We're monitoring and we're doing our job. So whether or not they cite us in the agreement is a bit of a moot point because we've got a mandate and we're exercising it. Whether or not the Canadians are involved or transferring or whatever, we're just doing our job. So the fact that the Minister of Defense was constantly referring to the role of the ICRC almost as a guarantee, and again, if the ICRC doesn't speak out, it doesn't mean that everything is going well. You can't imply either way. You cannot draw conclusions. However, if it does speak out publicly, you better be sure that there's something really serious happening, because that's really kind of a coded way of saying, you know, we haven't said anything publicly, now we are, so it's really bad. But you certainly cannot draw any conclusion from the fact that the ICRC is not expressing itself publicly, because it's doing its advocacy directly with those who are detained. So there was a time where the ICRC went public, in fact, and it made the front page news of the Globe and Mail and said that, no, that's not how it works. We're not going to report back to the Canadian authorities. We're going to, if we're visiting American facilities, we're reporting back to the Americans. If we're visiting NATO, we're, you know, and if we're visiting Afghan, then we're reporting to them. And so we're not going to start reporting back to the Dutch, to the Canadians, to all these other countries that are transferring. Canada's not the only one transferring. Now, there might be a difference in the agreement that's been signed on by the Dutch government, but certainly we're not in a position to have the logistics, and it's not in our modalities anyways to report back. And my last point is really to come back to Article 1 of the Geneva Convention, which I would argue is customary in nature, which says that the governments party to the Geneva Conventions have an obligation to respect and ensure respect. for the convention. So I would argue that there is a residual responsibility on the part of the Canadian government to do its job and get the concrete assurances to the treatment of detainees. So I'm hopeful that this is going to open the floor for some further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I guess before we throw it open to questions, Mr. Fenwick has a comment.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that I'm not regarded here as the spokesman on behalf of the culture. I think very simply and briefly put, torture or other mistreatment of any detainee, whether we like them or not, is unacceptable. Second, if Canadian soldiers are responsible for mistreatment, they should be held criminally culpable. That's all there is to it. Once again, it doesn't matter whether we like them more or they're there because of us. That's one of the rules they've got to comply with. And I think thirdly, Canada as a state does have a continuing responsibility, whether or not it's on the basis of Article 1, as Isabel puts it, or I would put it on the basis of Article 12 of the Third Geneva Convention. Mm-hmm. Canada does have a continuing responsibility for the proper treatment of any detainees initially taken by the Canadian forces. Period.
Okay, with that, we'll open it up to questions.
Yes, just a comment to Professor Penland's comment on torture. It's interesting. Being on appeal at the time, was ruled by the Israeli Superior Court in 1998, torture is illegal even in the face of imperative national security. And it's very instructive to explore that, because for us out in the field, when our clients tell us we have to use some means of extracting information, and the counter to that is, you'll get whatever information you want that person being tortured believes you want to hear, you'll get it, which might necessarily be what you want. But when you have a ruling like that in an area that is driven by conflict, it reinforces the notion that torture is not safe. Good.
I'm hoping to squeeze in a comment and a question. I get about zero comfort from the fact, if it's true that we have the legal right to be there when, you know, when bombs drop and kill people in this guy. And a question, what if there's a detainee, a hypothetical one, and he flashes a Pakistani passport, you know, says, I'm not from Afghanistan, I'm from Pakistan. Then what happens? Any other comments want to make about Pakistan's rule in Afghanistan?
I think we don't actually know the nationality of those being detained by the forces. So, but it wouldn't. In terms of protection, like what they're trying to protect you from? Is that your actual question, or are you saying, is it another jurisdiction we brought in here, or what?
Can I speak to that?
Please.
Okay. I would be inclined to think that essentially, if you pick up somebody who poses, who in a combat situation, you just keep them as a detainee. I don't think the Pakistani passport would have any impact. If I might use a very different example, but one that I'm a lot more familiar with, Omar Khadr, our man in Guantanamo, he was involved in allegedly a member of Al-Qaeda. He was involved in a firefight with American forces in Afghanistan, and as a result of which, apparently one American soldier was killed, and he was severely wounded and then apprehended, and the Americans carted him off to Guantanamo. I would be inclined to think that if Canadian soldiers had been the ones who'd come across Omar Khadr and he'd done the same thing he certainly would have been taken into custody. Now, exactly how he would have handled what he would do with one of your own, I don't know. But you're certainly not going to say, oh my goodness, you go home free, and just because of the nature of the passport. What happens, I'm not sure. But apprehension is certainly the start.
Yeah, I mean, but that, if I may, that would be the same in any armed conflict at the point of capture, because, you know, there are people of various nationalities there. So, they'd have to go through the usual kind of filtration thing. I think one of the interesting questions is, can you actually establish someone's identity very clearly in some of these contexts? I think that is genuinely a challenge. But in terms of what they're entitled, in terms of, you know, rights and detention and sort of thing, nationality in that sense is not relevant. In Guantanamo, it's become sort of, there's a big debate over whether or not they're entitled to consular access and that sort of thing, so there's some question as to what their actual status is as detainees. So. It's complicated, that's for sure.
Considering the complexities of these conflicts, what type of frameworks would the panel like to see set in place to deal with these type of detainees? Would you rather a NATO-run transparent system? Would you like them transferred to the U.S. in light of Gitmo and Task Force 626 and assorted other type of super prisons? Would you like to see a new creative framework to be able to deal with these unique systems and to pass that on in the future? Because since we're kind of dealing with an ambiguous situation, we're kind of writing it down as we go. So what would be the ideal situation and how do we get to that point?
I don't have an answer about the ideal situation, but I am puzzled by the fact that we are told that the Canadians do not have the capacity to detain themselves. So the Afghans have the capacity? I'm not saying that it's ideal that our country detains, but it should be an option, and I'd like it to be discussed and explored.
Or in a joint facility with NATO, as our
national
is saying.
Yeah.
But I think the other interesting question here is, I believe the Red Cross did rule at one point that it's no longer an international conflict, it's an international conflict. Yeah. So no one being detained in that context is a prisoner of war. That status only exists in international conflict. So it just begs the question of what is the status of the detainees. And part of our frustration is there's a lot of arguments out there that there needs to be this sort of new special category. And to what end is that being argued? It appears to be being argued out of a desire to detain people without charge and assess their intelligence value. It appears. You know, and I think there's other reasons why people get detained without charge in a country like Afghanistan, simply because of the struggle of the justice system to reconstruct. People actually get lost in the system, among other things. But you know, from our perspective, you know, we simply find the concept of detaining someone without charge unacceptable. You know, and question the suggestion that you need to create a category where that is possible. So you know, we're not a fan of people being transferred into other parts of U.S. war on what you might put war on terror, traditionally. System. It's an extensive detention system in which all of those rights appear to be suspended. You know, in Guantanamo, people were interrogated. Cotter was interrogated for years, from the ages of 15 to 18, without access to a lawyer. Imagine that. When you look at the charge sheet that's now against them in the military commission system, which I think it's fairly easily argued as far below the international standards for fair trial. You know, all of the references are to intelligence gathered from him in the first couple of months of his detention, but nonetheless, you know, 3 years of interrogation anyway. But it's quite, why you want to create a system like that is questionable. But there's a lot of effort being put into convincing people that there's a need to. From human rights perspective, give the person due process. You know, if I was just wondering, it's like cases like Arar show what can happen when you do not give someone a chance to challenge the basis for their detention. You know, tremendous energy was wasted on keeping this guy detained. Never mind what happened to him as a consequence of being detained. And there are plenty of other examples of someone being detained for a long period of time without grounds. and the energy put into to doing that, and the sort of misassumption and misinformation that goes with that, the poor intelligence gathering that goes with that. I think there's quite an argument for giving people due process. On the ground, you'll get some better intelligence on that and we'll redirect your energies. But I really question this desire to suggest the current legal frameworks are inadequate. Yeah. I think it's simply an attempt to get around them.
If I can speak to that briefly. First of all, whether or not the Red Cross rules, the Red Cross is not terribly authoritative. I mean, I've got a great deal of respect for the Red Cross. I also spent 4 years litigating cases at the International Tribunal for Yugoslavia, in which the Red Cross had decided the conflict was non-international, and we were able to, with I think good cause, to convince the court that the conflict was international. So unfortunately, there is nobody who makes a binding rule of what's what. Secondly, although I'm very tempted to agree with Hillary, I think there still is, at least for some conflicts, the international conflict. I mean, a prisoner of war is not somebody you put in because he or she has got a charge against them. And they are not regarded as a criminal. They're there for the duration of the conflict. So exactly what the quote due process is in that kind of situation, if that's the situation you're talking about, I'm not sure. I like the idea of transparency. I certainly am not speaking on behalf of anybody whatsoever. Maybe the idea of a NATO detention facility where everybody can see what's happening and you've got a record of all the people and they're treated properly in compliance with the Geneva Conventions, whether or not they technically apply, is the best we can come up with.
But here's the thing, none of these detainees are being approached as if they are prisoners of war. They're being approached as if they were criminal suspects for something when you look at how they're actually being treated in the detention system. And so I think, you know, that's sort of one of the things going on.
Or enemy combatants under the armed services bill.
Yeah. If you're going to treat someone as a prisoner of war, you don't toss them into a criminal detention facility in Afghanistan. Can we agree on that, though?
Okay.
There you go. And that's the reality, is they're trying to, you know, the National Director of Security is not a prisoner of war camp. That's the reality. But we could spend the whole day talking about yeah. But I mean, that's a key part of what's going on, you know.
Yes?
You know, we're talking something, the values of the developed nation. But we are working in a very underdeveloped country, which has been destroyed by the war. It's into the rebels. People are looking for the basic things, food, shelter, and the other very basic things. So, though we are trying to put a balance, you know, giving them the values, from the developed nations to those, so that do we have a basic network, a person, suppose somebody detained there, let us example, any quick method that I can inform my relative, I can inform my, anybody who look after this, all regulations like how the criminal or the prisoner of war system has to work, because that is the basic thing, you are detained, you should have right to inform instantly to somebody that this is, that I have been charged and somebody to defend for me, or should I, to the relatives, to the lawyers, or to the whatever the representatives they have, anything, the system like that. But this is the basic thing you have.
I mean, I think that the role of the Red Cross in terms of tracing and family messages is the beginning of that. It won't be a communication to a lawyer, but it will actually notify the family that this person is detained in this location. And I think that's a big safeguard in and of itself, because it also allows the family to make connection to perhaps visit the prisoner in the facility. Similarly, you know, as much as we register the prisoners and they have the right to write to their families, some families come to our offices looking for family members that have disappeared. And that's the other part of it, is the tracing part, where we actually are trying to see if we can connect this request from a family member to the registration of prisoners that we have across the country. But it doesn't include the notification to a lawyer.
You're talking of something, you know, Red Cross, go there by chance, or you visit a particular place. But I'm talking just the instant need, you know.
Yeah, we don't go by chance, we go...
Whatever, by appointments, or, you know, you visit the particular places under the four of the criteria as you mentioned. But the basic right of a detainee, you know, to instantly communicate the message to somebody who can help him out. Like you give the general messages, you know, he's in the prison and all that. But that's something before his torture, you know, his story, after his detention and that duration and the Red Cross intervenes or go and visit him. You know, and there should be some mechanism which is, you know, protective to him so that whatever he tells to the police or to the army, he should have something, you know, on his hand, oh, you know, I'm protected. Somebody's, my representative is there who will look after it to me.
But that's the role of the ICRC. That's exactly the type of monitoring that we do on the ground in terms of the judicial guarantees, the access to a lawyer. So we will actually, if those guarantees are not upheld by the authorities, we will tell the authorities, you must do this. We will monitor whether or not this is happening or not. So it's that monitoring function that we're trying to fulfill as much as possible.
I have a question about, well, I'd like to get your thoughts on your comments about natural justice or due process. Somebody is held as a detainee, and you should tell them what the case is that they're supposed to meet, right? Like they should be available to have full disclosure of the issues against them. But how do you reconcile that with any jeopardy that comes from national security perspectives? Is there sort of a relationship between national security threats by showing them full disclosure and their rights to full disclosure on the other hand?
In the Afghan context?
Yeah, well, in any...
I mean, you've got a system that can't meet any of that right now. I mean, people end up in a facility like the National Directorate of Security. Things aren't even rising up to the level where those questions are there.
And I think the confusion also between their status, is it prisoners of war or is it...
There's something.
The confusion around the status is really not helpful because, as was said before, if they're prisoners of war, they're immune from prosecution if they haven't done anything, you know, in contradiction with the rules of war. So the purpose of detaining them is not to punish them. It's to actually remove them from theater, from the hostilities, and kind of put them aside. So the confusion around whether they're prisoners of war or criminal suspects or is really unhelpful.
Yeah, but I mean, in general, that's the same question you have in Canada in a case like the Kowalka case under the anti-terrorism act, some of the security certificate cases. Like, to what extent, what is the reasonable ground for national security confidentiality? In the Canadian context, we feel that that's a little wide because it includes the term international relations. When we look at some of the last bits of stuff that was disclosed out of Iraq, you can see why we had the concerns. Because all that, we had to go, you know, that had was a long, extended court process, whereby some of that redaction was finally lifted. Under whatever law might be applied in a case in Afghanistan, we don't even know what their criteria are for that. I mean, that's why I say when the system can't even sort of handle that question yet. But it does come down to fundamentally. If they're a prisoner of war, then they can be charged. And if there's a specific criminal charge, then there's a process that has to go with that. You've got a system really challenged to deal with it.
We have one over here first.
Yeah, I was just wondering, what, if any, is there a distinction for detainees right now in Afghanistan, what's happening in Afghanistan, compared to in the past where Canada was involved in Cyprus or missions in Africa? Detainees were taken in there and, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I think those were very, very different missions. We weren't really involved in a combat setting. The peacekeeping operations is very unlikely.
Specifically because we are there in a combat type situation.
Yeah,
this is
I agree. Yeah.
This crossover of the different bodies of law that can apply, it really seems to blur the situation and it seems to get down to individuals as well. I can see the Afghan government, for example, saying somebody who's not a regular member of a combatant unit, but who goes out on one evening and assists somebody from outside the country to set a bomb is in fact a criminal. They're not a member of any fighting force. They may have been paid to do it. They may have done it out of fear or whatever. But they would seem to fall under, as anybody on the Canadian side would, in a criminal context. And that blurs it further. Coming back to that, it also seems that we have some blurring going on here. And this goes back to the argument of buyers and others to take it out of the law related to a international humanitarian law and drag it over into the obligations of individuals. And I'm just wondering, on that particular case, and I don't know much about how they've argued it, how do they get past the position that if you want to go to individual rather than state responsibility for these acts, as an amnesty is arguing state responsibility to take their obligations for prisoners, if there were in fact individuals who abused prisoners, they'd be subject to the Canadian military justice system. Are they making the allegation that they've tried that system and it refuses to prosecute, and therefore there's an argument for referring to the ICC? I mean, it smells unfortunately like a publicity stunt.
I can't explain Michael Blair's argument myself. Yeah. Just, we decided not to be
part of it. Yeah, okay.
I think you kind of have to ask him and Professor Adaran. You don't know if Bill can shed any light on it.
Yeah, I've argued with Michael about that. I think that basically, certainly the International Criminal Court does have a system in place where you can prosecute individuals. But I think, as a practical matter, it's only going to purport to exercise jurisdiction if for some reason or other the state authorities aren't capable of doing it. And I would think there's certainly a comprehensive enough justice system in place to handle that sort of thing in Canada. It's really easy to write to the International Criminal Court. It's a lot more difficult to get them to do anything. If I might use a slightly different example, when I worked at the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal, while the NATO bombing in connection with Yugoslavia was going on, I got deluged with letters encouraging me to prosecute, or encouraging us to prosecute Bill Clinton and Tony Blair and this sort of thing. Often enough, you get them described as, you know, the International Institute for the Enforcement of Humanitarian Law. And when you penetrated the corporate veil, you discover one LLM student constituted the entire organization. So I'm not sure the letter from Michael will necessarily trigger an awful lot of action.
But
no,
nor should it for
the
fact that the national jurisdiction is very capable here. And you know, come on, I just thought it would be. I like Michael too, really.
Excuse me, I have a small comment, and it's appointing something that I know the panel is about the prisoners in Afghanistan, but if Canada stay in Afghanistan and continue involved in this conflict, this is just one of the incidents that could be happening. And the tension between the application of the international humanitarian law and the goals of this mission in Afghanistan is going to be present also because the conflict in Afghanistan is very difficult to distinguish between people that is civilian people and who is the combat. And it is a huge task for the humanitarian law and for the Canadian forces in Afghanistan. Why? Because we're talking here about the framework, we're talking here about the enforcement, we're talking here about the prosecution. But what happens with all those things, if we don't have a framework before send the troops, if we don't have a framework before the action start or the extension of the action continue, this is the lack of the after when this kind of situation is going to happen, we don't have tools to really go to prosecute this situation and be clear in the national context when or how or who is accountable for this situation. I'm talking about these issues because
The international humanitarian law is a wonderful tool. It's a wonderful tool for education. It's a wonderful tool for create that framework. It's a wonderful tool to put in place and on the table this discussion. But now it's more than something that theory or politics. Canada has now troops in Afghanistan. Many of Canadian civilian soldiers have come back to Canada dead or even with terrible injuries. And all those kinds of things, if you prolong the stay or the position in Afghanistan, it is going to make more complex this context. And the prisoner is just one of the examples that I'm going to have it. And I'm talking about this because I know exactly how be involved in a conflict when determining who is the other, the enemy, is so difficult. And it's difficult for people who is in the same countries. How about from other people that coming from complete different culture, even don't know about the language, the culture, and nothing. That kind of assumption that we are coming here to create values and create democracy, and we are decent people. No, if they are not enough to really control and protect the international humanitarian law. Just my thought.
I think we probably have time for maybe one or two questions and then back to
it. This is actually just I remember you talking at the beginning about the Red Cross, but then you also had the Red Crescent and the Red Crystal. In countries that those are, I guess, used or present, are the responsibilities and the roles the same, or are they different from like the Red Cross?
So just to clarify, you've got the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is the international organism, part of the movement of the Red Cross and Red Crescent, that has a specific mandate to act in armed conflict and specifically also with prisoners and detainees. In national context, you would have a national society. So in Canada, you would have the Canadian Red Cross, the American Red Cross, the Iraqi Red Crescent, the Afghan Red Crescent. Those would be national entities that would have a broad scope of activities, which could range from water safety to first aid to disaster management and response. And in a situation of conflict, these national societies would come and assist the International Committee of the Red Cross. So they would continue the breadth of their activities, but they would come and support. For example, the SRC has also a lot of ortho centers because there are a lot of mine victims in Afghanistan, and many of those centers are operated by the SRC, but really supported by the Afghan Red Crescent Society.
And I think I should mention the last question in the interest of getting to lunch.
Seems to me that the international humanitarian law is sort of designed to deal with sort of nations, you know, just treaties or something, that kind of thing. But the current conflict we're dealing with in Afghanistan, and I guess in Iraq, although we're not directly there, we're dealing with non-national groups, Al-Qaeda, that kind of thing. So how do you guys feel that the international humanitarian law is responding to this new challenge, or how should it respond to this new challenge?
I'll try. You're right. International humanitarian law is designed to apply to international armed conflicts, which are conflicts involving states, and non-international armed conflicts, which normally have been regarded as conflicts which are confined to the boundaries, more or less, of a single state. When what you've got is something like Al-Qaeda, which is a non-state actor operating across state boundaries, you've got a bunch of additional problems. And IHL, it wasn't designed initially to apply to that situation. I think, however, you've got a variety of options. You've got an option which unfortunately seems to have been very popular in the United States, where you have people writing opinions that, hey, there's no law, we can do whatever we want, which I have to find contemptible. You've got another option, which is you can say, well, really, it's the best vehicle for solving this is law enforcement, and look on it as a maybe a, a very big law enforcement issue. Or I guess you can somehow or other shoehorn the IHL into it. The approach that seems to have been taken more recently by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Hamden decision is to say, well, at a minimum, Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions provides basic standards which apply to all conflicts, so we'll live with that. There is, I used the expression legal fiction when I was talking earlier. I think that is probably a concept which is not talked about nearly often enough here, because I think sometimes what you're doing is really saying, well, I'm not sure what applies, but this looks like it provides the most usable set of standards, so let's push that in somehow or other. But the law has some difficulty adjusting to this, but I don't think saying there's no law is a good idea at all. I think you've got to, if you want to protect basic human values, you've got to push something into that gap.
I think the other issue here that we need to look at, is, I mean, especially when Al Qaeda is being referred to, because let's face it, that's like the McDonald's of terrorism now. Everybody, there's Al Qaeda everywhere, you know. You know, I mean, that sounds really funny, but it's become, or, you know, the way people say Kleenex or, you know, Skidoo instead of snow machine and tissue, you know, it's, in other words, it's become this sort of sweeping reference to something. And what gets lost in there is a real understanding of who is the actor, what is it actually doing, and, you know, so there's this assumption that if it's Al-Qaeda, it's a generic thing over here, that is outside all this other stuff. And I think it does have to come back to, you know, what has actually happened? Has, you know, was that simply a murder, but it's being dressed up in languages of terrorism and Al-Qaeda and so on? Or, you know, what the heck is it? You know, and I think we need to bring some of it back to that. You know, some of what is going on is connected to narco trafficking, I hate that word too, but to criminal behavior. Some of it is connected to political needs, some of it to other things. And to come back a bit to that. The you know, overuse of words like terrorism. There are specific acts, you know, there's specific treaties internationally that have identified certain acts as terrorism, you know. But the word gets used very broadly for all sorts of reasons. And we do have to come back to, you know, what is actually going on. You know, the person who's being called a terrorist, the group that's being called a terrorist, referred to as Al-Qaeda. What is that situation? And then come back to questions of law. There's lots of law around there. It could be domestic law that is applying in that context. And some of these other laws aren't, you know, they're there for private discussion. But it could simply be, whether it's Malaysia or whatever, that could be a crime quite regularly under domestic law that could be prosecuted. And to bring some of sort of poke holes in the rhetoric. And I think that's, with sort of all of this, that's a caution, you know, to come back to what has actually happened, not what is sort of the brand names being put on. Nonetheless, many legal challenges exist, of course, but I think that's, particularly with an anti-law crowd, that's a very important thing to think about.
Okay, well, I think with that, we should wrap things up. And I just want to personally say, as somebody that's looked at some of these issues from a defense policy standpoint, that all this legal mumbo jumbo was far more interesting than I anticipated.